87.
Hey, this is Matt Rothschild.
And this is KATN LPFM Radio 106.9, Salida, Colorado, and Truth Quest with Melody. And there's an opening song by Eric Carlstrom. And then we'll get into our interview.
Jimmy was a tall and a skinny, funny-looking kid. He and I was best friends in the second grade. We was always cutting up and giving our teacher fits. But he was in that purple reader all the way. By the time that we grew up to high school age, he'd read most of Steinbeck and was writing poetry. He was playing on the football team, picking folk songs with Ames and Dave and me. Then one summer day, my family moved out west. I had to say goodbye to all my childhood friends. But a few years later, I set out to hitchhike in from Flagstaff back to Arlington. There I found Jimmy looking all pale and weak and drawn. He was singing lead now in a rock and roll band. And I watched him stick a needle in his arm, like his hero, that other Jimmy was doing then. Then I spent a few days at my aunt and uncle's house, revisiting my second family. Seemed they were all healthy and busy and living well. He was high up in the CIA. A little bit later I heard that Jimmy died. OD'd on the bathroom floor. The word was that he'd really tried to clean up, straighten out once more. Well, those crazy times never made much sense to me. The war, the drugs, and all the casualties. It's only looking back now that finally I begin to see things are not at all the way that they were said to be. It was war for drugs and drugs for war. It was all big profits for those Wall Street banks. It was CIA agents stealing heroin to our soldiers in Vietnam. It was stuffing white powder from Laos in the body bags. They could hide 50 pounds inside each man. That's how they shipped the stuff back to America. How it ended up in Jimmy's veins. Now I wonder if the ones who shipped those drugs ever had to spend a day in jail. Or if those Wall Street drug lords ever lost a night of sleep and missed a meal. But it seems the justice system here is broken now, and it's the criminals that rule. But I reckon they'll still have to face a higher law and a judge that can't be bought or fooled. Gazing now into this mystery, how our lives are wagered, sold, and spent. But as these years go drifting by, I sometimes miss my childhood friends. Jimmy was a tall and a skinny, funny-looking kid. He and I was best friends in the second grade.
We was always cutting up and giving our teacher fits. But he was in that purple reader all the way.
That was Ode to Jimmy by Eric Carlstrom, and you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and it's on KHEM LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info. are linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host tonight is Professor Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest this evening is Dr. Steve Filling. And Dr. Carlstrom is professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using soils and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And Eric, are you there?
Yeah, but I can't hear you, Melody.
Oh, okay.
Turn yourself up.
Okay, how's that?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, all right. And I'll let you go ahead and introduce Steve. He is returning from, we did a prior interview a couple of months ago, and we're going to follow up with what we had originally talked about, and I'll let Dr. Carlstrom get into that.
Speak up, Melody.
You're still not hearing me.
I'm still not hearing you.
Okay. Will you go ahead and see how if it comes through, and I'll go ahead and get off of here and let you and Steve talk.
Okay.
And it comes through.
I'll begin. We had a conversation last fall with Professor Filling, who was the Speaker of the Faculty Senate at California State University, Stanislaus. And the topic of our discussion was the downsizing, restructuring, and cutbacks. You might even say attempted privatization of the California State University, which is one of the very, very large three-tiered system of public education in California, which is comprised of the University of California schools like UC Berkeley and UC Davis and UCLA and UC Irvine, which are the research-oriented institutions. And then the 23-campus California State University system, which is oriented more towards teaching undergraduates, particularly with an emphasis on training other teachers for the public school system. And then we have about 104, something like that, junior colleges. So we have a very extensive public education system, but due to the budget cutbacks that we've seen over the last 10 years, and especially this last year, we're seeing real restructuring attempts at downsizing the California State University system. And there have been lots of developments since our last conversation several months ago. So I'll just begin and welcome Dr. Steve Filling and ask you if I could start with the white paper, or if you'd like to just start telling us what's happening now, that would be great, too.
Okay. Good evening. Hi, Eric.
Yeah, hi.
You're hearing that okay?
Yes, I'm hearing you. Thank you.
Okay. Great. Well, one thing to add is they're getting worse, and the pace of change has accelerated to an extent, although California's governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, recently announced that higher education is going to be an emphasis in his budget for 2010-2011. So he proposed refunding a bit of what he'd taken away from higher education in the last couple of years. Unfortunately, most of the commentators and indeed the legislative auditor of California don't think his budget is actually going to be workable. They're pretty sure that we're not going to get that money again. So, as I said, things consider, just continue apace.
Okay, well, just to kind of recap where we left off last time, due to the budget cuts that we saw last fall, we saw something like, I think, 22% of our faculty cut, and something like 104 classes were cut. Students were turned away at the door for the first time in the history of the California State University, and this was the mandate of the chancellor of our system, that now we're going to start drawing the line, closing the doors, and making it harder for students to get in. And so we saw big shakeup at our university. And in fact, if we look around the system, we see that our university, California State University Stanislaus, was hit harder and had more cuts, more budget cuts, than any other of the California State Universities. And it's perhaps not a coincidence that our president, Dr. Hamid Shirvani, wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education last October, I believe, which is the main news outlet for all higher education in the country, in which he said this is an opportunity to re-engineer and restructure education. We should no longer look at a higher education as a right. We should look at it as a privilege. Faculty shouldn't be spending so much time on faculty governance, shared governance. They shouldn't be spending so much time on research. They should be just teaching classes. I guess he wants to bring us to the level of junior colleges or high school maybe. So it seems that our president has been singled out as the single worst of the college presidents, or at least the most aggressive his expressed desire and his actual implemented desire to restructure and downsize universities. So some of my colleagues talk about a failure of leadership. I think maybe that's a very almost an understatement. Would you comment on the import of that letter that President Shirvani wrote to the Chronicle of Higher Education, Steve?
Sure. I think, to me, there's one section that speaks reams about his attitude about higher education. It goes, and I quote, "We should view the privilege of a higher education much as we did the privileges that we enjoyed as children. We knew we couldn't get ice cream if we didn't help wash the dishes. Those special activities were available to us, but we did not enjoy them as a right." And to me, that betrays a basic difference in understanding of what we're about between he and I. I don't think education is like ice cream. It's a reward for doing something distasteful. I think it is a way of improving the lives of our students. And I take it very seriously. The state of California, when it established the California State University system, mandated that we were to serve the upper one-third of high school graduates in California. I don't see anything in that enabling legislation that talks about privileges or doing dishes or ice cream. And
yeah,
I think,
go ahead.
When our campus president, Shirvani, goes on about things like that, he radically recharacterizes what the CSU is about. We were not intended to be a privilege. We were intended to be part of a higher ed system that served our society. The people that I work with, including you, Eric, are largely really intent upon that mission, trying to educate, I guess you could say, the rest of us, speaking as somebody who was a graduate of one of those schools just like the CSU. UC has its place. The University of California is the research institution in California. What CSU is about is providing an education for the rest of us, and we think that's a very worthwhile goal. And to me, it's a very sad day that the CSU will support someone like Dr. Shirvani, whose notion is that we should turn this into a privilege system and tell people, too bad, go away.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what our chancellor has instructed us to do. We are, in his words, to serve 45,000 fewer students next year. that's a problem for us.
Yeah, and of course this would be not only downsizing our education system, our public education system, but it would also involve downsizing the middle class. It would involve as well as privatizing the public education system. I'd just like to read a little bit from what we call the white paper that came out from the California Faculty Association in December of 2009, so that's just a month ago. And it's entitled Restructuring, quote-unquote, the CSU or Wrecking It, ? What proposed changes mean and what we can do about them. And it talks the first of the attack on the CSU mission, which is actually fairly well spelled out in a mission statement, which we can talk about later, which is, as you say, to educate the citizens of California to increase their knowledge, learning, and culture base and provide opportunities for development intellectually, personally, and professionally, prepare significant numbers of educated, responsible people to contribute to California's schools, economy, culture, and future, to encourage and provide access to an excellent education, to all who are prepared for and wish to participate in collegiate study, to offer undergraduate and graduate instruction leading to bachelor's and higher degrees in the liberal arts and sciences, to prepare students for an international multicultural society, to provide public services that enrich the university and its communities. Okay, that's our stated mission, but that mission has been subverted to a significant extent, mainly by our leadership, that is to say our chancellor and our president, and our governor, for sure. And they actually, in this white paper, they talk about our own president, where it says, even starker are the comments of Hamid Shirvani, president of CSU Stanislaus, in a commentary surreally titled, Will a Culture of Entitlement Bankrupt Higher Education? Chronicle of Higher Education, October 18, 2009, Shirvani suggests that budget cuts to the CSU actually offer an opportunity to, quote, re-engineer education, quote, unquote, in a way that reduces Californians' quote, sense of entitlement to a college education, which he says, quote, has driven expansion in higher education beyond what is reasonable or necessary, unquote. Shirvani underscores what he calls the practical realities, unquote, that require wholesale change, and this is a quote from his paper, his article, the economy has suffered changes so deep and fundamental that institutions cannot just hunker down to weather the storm. The time has come for creative reconstruction. We must summon the courage and will to re-engineer education. Shirvani's heroic tone in phrases like, quote, creative reconstruction suggests he believes, or would have his readers believe, that budget cuts are leading to positive changes in universities, no matter what students, parents, professors, or staff may think. By arguing that the demand for public education, one, is a problem, and two, has been fueled by California's sense of so-called, quote, entitlement to that education, and three, must now come to an end, Shirvani tries to reframe these staggering budget cuts as an opportunity to create his vision for a better, smaller university that does not waste resources on those who are not deserving enough. But what Shirvani calls entitlement has been a 50-year promise to Californians expressed in the Master Plan for Higher Education. Moreover, for the majority of our state students, it has provided the opportunity to thrive and to participate meaningfully in our democracy. Shirvani's vision of a, quote, reconstructed, unquote, university sends a chilling message to Californians that access to college degrees should be curtailed and the capacity of the state university must be permanently reduced. For those of us who work or learn in the CSU, Shirvani's language is both infuriating and laughable. Deep sacrifices have been made by students, faculty, and staff over the last 10 years in our cuts, in our budget cuts, and it is obvious that budget cuts have already undermined the quality of a CSU education and access to the state university for thousands. The very reason for having the California State University is being lost. Okay, so yes, our president seems to have distinguished himself even even in the present difficult situation, for his aggressive attempts to restructure, to re-engineer the university. And Steve, how would you characterize what you see as the thrust or the direction of those changes at our institution?
To me, it goes back to a notion made famous by Joseph Schumpeter, one of the Austrian school economists, that notion of creative destruction that people, I guess, paraphrasing slightly, people let things go and get fat, dumb, and happy, and things fall apart, and then they become innovative and create something even better than before. And I'm pretty sure that people in the CSU system were not being fat, dumb, and happy. I think that our own campus has graduation rates at about 52%, which puts us in the top 20% in the nation with respect to schools like ours. In other words, I think we're succeeding pretty well at educating people and getting them degrees and getting them out. And when we do studies about why that is, what comes up is things like relatively small class sizes, faculty that actually know the students and interact with them on a personal level repeatedly, things like community-engaged learning, things like our winter term where we have the freedom, given a one-month course, to take students to off-site for a couple weeks and explore the world. Those are all the sorts of things that enhance learning, and those are the very things that our president, under the pretext of budget cut necessity, is trying to get rid of. And I find it especially ironic, given that right up until about a year ago, our president was the biggest advocate of growing as quickly as you can, as much as you can, that there was in the CSU. He makes much of, we've grown too much and we've grown too fast, and that was a dumb thing to do. And what he leaves out is that he was one of the people leading the charge to grow.
Well, as I recall, and I heard this at one of our faculty meetings, a president is judged basically by three criteria by his higher-ups, which would be the chancellor and the Board of Regents. And one is the amount of growth or the student enrollments, and another would be incoming money, grants, et cetera, and another would be the number of grievances which have been filed on campus. So these would be indicators of a president's success. So he would have had the motivation or the reason to want to grow, simply to look good and shine for his annual report card, I suppose. So I suppose that he's echoing sentiments which are coming from the chancellor and the Board of Regents and the governor when it comes to slamming on the brakes and lowering the enrollments now for the first time in our experience. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I think what I see when I looked at what goes on in the CSU is about what I'd expect to happen if some of the students who sit in my MBA classes who don't pay a lot of attention and get about half of what I said were to run an organization. He knows buzzwords, and he doesn't have any idea of the underlying realities. He's been told you need to cut the size of your university, and he knows that there's opposition to it, so he tries to create a story that makes what he's doing sensible. I don't think he succeeds.
Well, we had go ahead, I'm sorry.
One of his latest bits, again, coming out of the chancellor's office, there was another article in the Chronicle of Higher Education this week announcing this new plan the CSU has to step up graduation rates, as they put it. And the notion is that each campus should increase graduation rates by 6.5% within 6 years. Now, that's a laudable scheme, except that it does matter that when people leave here, they leave with an education, not just with a piece of paper saying they graduated. And again, at a time when we have less money and we're doing budget cuts, we're being told that we have to trim the number of classes in the case of our campus, at a time when we have literally gotten rid of 22% of our faculty, it seems really strange that we're going to say we're going to increase graduation rates when we know that the factors that increase graduation rates require more faculty, more interaction, and more classes for students to take.
Well, we have a great secretary in my department, and the way she put it, and of course she's been here as long as I have, since 1990, she says it seems like the higher-ups are setting us up for failure. In other words, they're setting it up so that we can't succeed. Of course, then the question is whether this is coming from incompetence or whether this is a deliberate strategy.
My intuition is that it's a bizarre combination of both. I don't think that people that sit in high administrative positions really want to fail. I think there's a basic disconnect in their understanding of what failure means. They use a lot of metaphors of the factory. They talk about how when we look at our students and graduation rates, we should, quote, just understand that some are going to fall off the conveyor belt, unquote. And for a lot of people that teach these students, we're talking about human beings. We're not talking about pieces of chocolate on a conveyor belt. And the notion that we should just allow some of them to fall off and accept that as a cost of doing business is something that a lot of us find pretty odious.
Well, we could talk about the winter term saga and the drama because unilaterally the president went ahead and canceled winter term for next year. We still have a winter term this year, but contradicting all the faculty advisory committees that had made reports about whether winter term should be kept and all the opinion polls among students, I think 80 or 90% of the students want winter term. And the faculty overwhelmingly wants it. The president went ahead and canceled it. I know some of the students in my class, at least one of them was involved in a petition, and they've got, I think, 850 student signatures requesting to keep winter term. They brought it to the upper administration, and the administration turned around and said, no, you need 3,000 signatures. So they went and got 3,000 signatures, and they brought it back, and they did that within a week. And then the administration said, no, that's not enough. So then they went and got 9,000 signatures, which is, at least this is what I'm told, which is more than we have students. So either students were signing it twice or they're getting other people to sign. I know lots of faculty probably signed. But anyway, then they turned this in, and then they were told that, no, that's not going to help either. So there's a concerted, determined attempt to ignore all feedback and input from the other sectors of the university, and as it stands right now, there is no winter term next year. But this Friday, there is, a funeral for winter term slated for our campus. And from what I understand, some of the students have actually talked about, or maybe they are, filing suit against the president because they've all come in under certain catalog conditions and need winter term to get out in a timely manner. Can you elaborate on where we're at on the winter term drama?
Yeah, and for those that aren't familiar with it, our college runs on a what's called a 4-1-4 calendar. That is, we have a fall semester that runs September through December. January is a semester all by itself. We call it winter term, and then spring runs February through the end of May. So our president has, over the advice of faculty, over the past probably 25 years, we've actually done 14 analyses of winter term on our academic calendar. Every one of those analyses has said this has value, it helps our students graduate, it makes sense for us to do this. And in fact, if you look at the advertising materials our university produces, there's quite a few mentions of winter term in there about the unique nature of our education. Why does it matter? Well, for that 1 month, our students take one class. So they're able to focus on something. So I have, for instance, some students who have a problem with math. They take their math classes in January when they don't have any other classes as a distraction. They tell me that works better for them. I teach a class, a community service class, that teaches people how to do tax returns, and we go off and do tax returns for low-income families in the area, helping the community and helping our students understand a bit about how the tax system works and indeed how personal finance works. That's possible because they have a one-month period at that time of the year. Our president decided he wanted to get rid of it, largely in pursuit of having us be plug-and-play with lots of other universities. That is, we're going going to shift and be on the same calendar as several others. The downside to that, we don't have a winter term anymore. Faculty recommended against it. The students recommended against it. In fact, today we were given another resolution by our student government saying, no, they really want to keep their winter term. They went through those petitions you mentioned and figured out after they take out the faculty and the community members and the alumni, there were approximately, I believe, 3,200 students, current students, who'd signed those petitions, which equates to right about 40, 45, 50% of our student body. That's a huge number of students to get to sign anything. So, you know, when the president did this, he said that he was going with the students and looking out for their best interests. Well, pretty clearly, the students don't agree that he's looking out for their best interests. So, unilaterally, he makes a decision. People have been protesting it. I know that the Faculty Association has filed a couple grievances about it. I believe that some of our students have talked to attorneys about it. I truthfully am not part of that. I don't know what they're doing with it, so I don't know where that's at. But I think there's a very active resistance movement. And the funeral for winter term you mentioned is actually happening tomorrow on our campus. I'm told that our students are going to have a open casket viewing of our winter term, and they intend to present our president with those 3,100 signatures from the students and ask him to rethink his decision.
Yeah, there have been some very effective protests, very creative, I think, from our students. A lot of insight. I've learned a lot just, you know, from dialoguing with the students about what's going on. There was about a 10-minute YouTube that was put on by our music department. And I can't remember the name of that thing, Steve, but it was very effective. I'll just kind of run through the plot of it. It starts off with our choir, our students singing Joy to the World, I think. And then, as they go through the song, one by one, the students put a kind of a black piece of tape or cloth over their mouths, and they're silenced. And so, by the time you get to the end of the song, you know there's nobody singing. They drop out one by one, and then the message is, "We will not be silenced." And it gives the statistics of the fact that, you know, we have this many students in the music program, and they're trying to cut, you know, this many faculty, and they're just destroying the music program. And then they show these students marching into the administration building and across campus, and trying to preserve their academic program. So music is one of those programs that has kind of been singled out for, if not program elimination, certainly program reduction. And the students have come back with, I think, some very creative protests that anybody could watch on the YouTube if they were clever enough to find it.
Yeah, and that protest actually was based on the annual holiday concert. Every year, our music students go into the big administration building, and they usually do a holiday concert for an hour or so. So this year, when they're faced with the fact that somewhere between 40 and 70% of their concentrations were going to disappear next year, they came up with the notion of, we'll do the concert, and then, as you say, they just sort of sequentially gagged themselves, and at the end of the song, there's nobody left singing. Some of the art students brought in their artworks for display, and at the end of the performance, they proceeded to rip their prints up, because if those budget cuts go forward, we don't have a program that talks about prints. We don't have the photography specialization anymore. I think that we're very effective at helping people understand what we would be losing. Our campus has been renowned as the place for people that want to teach music in the K-12 systems to go to school, because we have both a really excellent College of Education and some people really dedicated to teaching music. And that's being threatened. They made their point very well. Unfortunately, some of the folk in the administration were a little less than happy, and they made comments like, "You spoiled our holiday system. How dare you?" I guess not thinking too much for the students who would no longer be able to graduate, or indeed the faculty who no longer had jobs. They've done similar protests. They did one last fall for the 100 and 712, whatever it was, courses that were canceled. They had sort of a mock funeral for the classes. I've been so impressed with our students' ingenuity, and more than that, I'm humbled by their willingness to be involved, by how much they care. A lot of people would look at this situation and say, you know what, I'm going to be out of here in a year, in 2 years. That's somebody else's fight. Our students haven't. They've been involved. They've done exactly what we teach them to do. They've exercised their critical thinking skills. They've figured out what's an effective response, and they've tried to be an active part of the community. I don't think we could ask for more from our students.
Yeah, I think it's poignant on our campus because we have a large minority population. We have a lot of Hispanics, and we have many kinds of minorities. We are, you know, very multicultural, and I think what we see happening is that our campus seems to be targeted for more restructuring, more cutbacks than other campuses, and it starts to look a little bit like an elitist play against the less wealthy segments of our society. And I think our students understand that what's at stake is their future and the future of the middle class in this country, and the future of the hopes for people in their, you know, in their families and in their groups. So yeah, you're right. They're critically thinking and they're responding, I think, appropriately. Now, why is it, would you say, Steve, that as I recall, the average for the 23 CSU system, the average for all campuses was 8% faculty cutbacks or 8% faculty loss. We had 22%, which is the largest percentage of any of the CSU campuses. Why do you suppose that our campus has been hit particularly hard with the budget crisis that we've all experienced?
Well, I think part of it has to do with where we entered the budget difficulties. We were somewhere between $1 and $3 million already in the hole because of some bad administrative decisions. As one of the administrators put it, well, our vice president for business and finance made a mistake of $1.5 million. That is, he told the people responsible for controlling the budget that we had $1.5 million more than we did, and they duly spent it. And then at the end of the year, it turned out, well, we didn't actually have that money to spend. So we started out in a relatively worse place. It's also true that these cuts impact us perhaps more than, for instance, San Francisco State or San Diego State, because we're about one quarter the size of those institutions. That is, there's much less of us to cut. And I think this is furthered by our president's agenda, which seems to have to do with turning us into a factory and convincing the faculty that their role is to sit down and shut up and do whatever he says. Our campus, I think, probably put 80 to 90% of our budget cuts through direct instruction. That is, through faculty, through classroom maintenance, through equipment, whereas a lot of the other campuses tended to spread things about. So they would not only cut the budget for instruction, they might cut the budget for intramural sports, they might cut the athletics department, they might cut the president's office, they might cut all sorts of administrative areas. That didn't happen on our campus. If we look at the number of people charged with administering the system rather than doing work, rather than teaching classes, we see that that's gone up. We see that those people are paid better. For instance, our president just announced that he's hired another half-time person to do media relations. The stated point of hiring that person was, as the president put it, well, the state budget's complicated, and we need to make sure the media understand the budget and the impact on the CSU Stanislaus budget. I had offered the suggestion that paying that person $65,000 for half a year's work probably does buy us somebody who can talk to the press. But when I see that $65,000, what I see is not somebody talking to the press and producing articles in the press saying, give these people money. What I see is 12 classes that aren't going to be taught. I'm not sure that we need to be worrying so much about what's in the newspaper about our budget. Frankly, our vice presidents for business and our president can't explain the budget to me, and I'm a CPA. So I don't think they're going to have much luck explaining it to a newspaper reporter. I think more important to us might be doing what we're supposed to do, teaching classes, graduating students, helping people transform their lives, helping them become part of the middle class.
Well, two points come to mind here, Steve. We have many faculty committees, and this is part of our historic structure, which has been put in place over decades of shared governance of the university. And one of these important committees is the University Budget Advisory Committee, also known as UBAC. And UBAC has worked pretty hard to try to help the president with budget problems, but they have found that the president and the administration has not been at all forthcoming in telling them, how the money has been spent in the past and how the money is being spent now. In other words, there's no transparency. There is, in fact, a black wall of secrecy. You have anything to add to that? And then the other thing that comes to mind is I think I've been told we have something like 13 or 15 vice presidents now, each making high salaries. And I think over about 15 years ago, our campus only had one. So we've seen this incredible proliferation of vice presidents, all making, in excess of $200,000, maybe $300,000 a year. And how many classes could that cover if we cut down our vice presidents down to, one or two instead of 13 or 15?
Well, I think you're correct. We do have more vice presidents than we have then. The standard line from our administration and indeed from the chancellor's office is we need those people to make sure the rest of you are working. My contention, based on what I know about my colleagues after spending the last 16 years with them, is that they work incredibly hard. I see staff people. You mentioned your department staff person. I know this is also true of the staff that sort the mail, the staff that process student loans. They work very hard. They care so much about our students. They care about making our place work. They take work home with them. Even if they're paid by the hour, they'll take stuff home just to make sure it gets done so things happen for our students. When I look at our faculty, I see people who work in averages 60 hours a week. They're available to our students all the time. They're taking stuff home with them. Most of the people I know spend their Saturdays and Sundays grading papers rather than watching football games or going to the gym. I'm not sure we need quite so much supervision for those people. It seems to me most of them are doing whatever they can to get our job done. It's just not there. In terms of how many classes, well, the average vice president, and when we say we have 13 or 14 vice presidents, that includes what are called assistant vice presidents, sort of vice presidents in training, I guess. Their average salary probably is $120,000, $140,000, which means, well, that's probably 20 to 30 classes that could be taught. And when we factor in the fact that the benefits ratio for our MPPs is usually somewhere around 50%, obviously it's even more. So do we need quite so many people watching the rest of us work? I'm not at all sure. I'm not at all sure that we need people writing reports about how many classes Steve teaches. Steve teaches more classes, actually, than he's contractually mandated to, so I'm a little confused why we need somebody to write reports and watch that so carefully. This doesn't seem a situation where there are slackers here. If anything, quite the opposite. We have people that quite literally work themselves into illness because they care so much about getting things to work here. In terms of what goes on, well, here's a good example. We just got informed by the chancellor's office how things are going to work next summer. typically summer is not a part of our academic year, so students pay extra for that. And what we were told this year is that students will be charged the state rate. However, they will be also charged a, quote, user fee, unquote, to cover the overhead involved in having them in classes. That user fee amounts to about $80 per credit union, which means for our students it's about probably another $480 in fees for the summer course. At the same time, the faculty are being told, well, you're going to be paid somewhere about probably 5 to 25% less than you would make teaching that course during the academic year. So we have a case where we charge the students more, we pay the faculty less, we offer fewer classes. You can understand why our students are a little upset.
Well, yeah, and of course this last year, all of us have been, all of us at the university, all university employees have been furloughing, which means we're taking off mandatorily. We're taking off, I think, 2 days a month, and are paid 10% less of our salaries. And at the same time, this past year, because of the quote-unquote budget crisis, many of us, or most of us perhaps, are told to teach more. And so we get a higher workload, and we're making less money. So it's a little bit like what happens at a Walmart or something like that when you downsize the number of employees and then just spread their work around to those that remain. In what ways would you say what would be the trends that you see in terms of our university as we move towards a more downsized, privatized model? Now, our president, Hamid Shirvani, was president of Chapman College, which is a for-profit, mostly education-oriented university, and of course there's others. There are many other privatized universities, and the idea is to make a profit for shareholders. So then the university itself becomes a corporation, a for-profit corporation. And of course, a lot of there's a kind of a package of transformations that need to be implemented in order to shift a public education system towards a privatized model. And what would you see those changes being?
Well, I guess since you brought up Chapman, there's another point to be made there. When Shirvani was the provost at Chapman, one of his actions was to remove winter term from their schedule. It caused such an upset among students and faculty that he ended up having to put it back. So it seems in some sense that limited bag of tricks that most administrators have keeps coming out. In terms of becoming more, as he puts it, entrepreneurial, the idea is that we respond quickly to the market. So if the market happens to think, well, we need to produce some, X-ray technicians, then we should instantly start up a degree program for X-ray technicians, and then apparently 2 weeks later, when there's not a market for it, we should cancel it. If the market says, well, we need nurses, we should expand our nursing program. As soon as the market says, well, not so much, we should stop producing nurses completely. It's a mechanism for really overreacting to what may be transitory economic trends. I think when the president talks about entrepreneurialism, truthfully, speaking as a business person, as somebody who has functioned in the real world, I usually scratch my head because neither the president nor the provost, nor indeed our vice president for business and finance, who talk so glibly about entrepreneurialism and the new way of approaching things and treating stuff like a business, none of those folks have ever actually functioned in a business. They haven't been entrepreneurs. They talk whereof they do not know. There is a story about the oil business in the Mideast in the 30s, just leading up to World War II and shortly thereafter. It seems that there was a person in Turkey who had a huge amount of influence over who got to buy oil and how it was transported. And he's widely known as Mr. 5%, because he just wanted to take 5% off all the transactions. And that seems to be one of the characteristics of our president as well. For instance, I teach for the executive MBA program, which is one of those entrepreneurial branches of the university. That's taught through extended education. We charge the students considerably more. I think right now they're paying about $28,000 for the executive MBA program. If they were in the regular MBA program, it would be probably about, I guess, $12,000 to $15,000. So they're paying a lot more. They're given textbooks, et cetera. Out of that money, the faculty are paid, and every one of our administrative levels seeks to drain some of that off. So the president wants to drain some of the executive MBA money off. The provost wants to drain some off. The business college is saying, well, we actually think we should take that money and go hire some more faculty so we can afford to teach these classes so that we have people to cover the classes. Well, we're not doing that. So it's a very peculiar form of entrepreneurialism that seems to misunderstand the very nature of business. Rather than investing in the future of the business, the notion is, well, let's find a way to make a few bucks and take it out of the system as quickly as possible, which, again, speaking as a business person, is a recipe for failure.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the main structural differences between a public or state sponsored education system and a privatized one would be that in the former, the main amount of the costs of the student's education is underwritten by state taxes, whereas in the latter of the for-profit institution, the student has to pay the bulk of the charges, the costs. And
well,
we're certainly seeing a shift in that direction, as we saw, a 32% increase in tuition this year, and we're talking about similar increases next year, all across the board for the CSU and the UC system.
Which does make a difference for our students, who I've literally lost students between fall and spring because they can't afford 32% more. And, you know, when the Board of Trustees talks about this, when Chancellor Reed talks about it, when President Trevani talks about it, they say, well, it's the students that are benefiting, so it's the students that should cough up the money. They can borrow money. They can go get a job, whatever. The demographics of our institution are that our students are older than typical college students. I think our average age runs about 26. The vast majority of them, in the case of my classes, I know because I do surveys, 80% of them work more than 30 hours a week. 75% of them have families and children. They don't have huge amounts of disposable income. They can just say, okay, well, so school costs another $1,000 this semester. Fine, I'll just pay the $1,000. They don't have the $1,000. The promise of California's master plan for higher education was always to provide people the chance to get the education and know that the dollars would come after that. And one of the things that people have demonstrated repeatedly is that higher education provides huge benefits to society as a whole. There are a number of people, including some fairly conservative folk like Meg Whitman, the Republican candidate for governor, who will fess up and admit quite freely that part of the reason for the huge economic booms California has experienced over the last 40 years are indeed the fact that California made higher education possible. That is, they produced a well-educated and a hardworking workforce. We are chiseling away at our ability to do that. And the not-too-surprising conclusion is going to be that, well, California doesn't have such a highly educated workforce. They aren't going to be innovative. Maybe that's not the place people want to put their businesses anymore. There are some estimates that for every dollar that we spend on higher ed, society in general gets a return of about $100. That includes the taxes people pay on their higher incomes. It includes the fact that they're spending things in the community. It includes the fact that given higher education, they're able to make better decisions. They're able to be more innovative. They're able to create new products. I mean, one of the comparisons often made is, should we put people in prison? Should we put them in school? prisons cost somewhere between $40,000 and $60,000 per year per inmate. That's in California today. That's not including all the money that the federal government thinks we should be spending on prisons, another couple billion dollars. The average cost to us of having a student in higher ed is probably closer to maybe $12,000 to $15,000. Pretty clearly, higher education works a lot better than prison. And there are statistics demonstrating, again, pretty conclusively, that incarceration and education are inversely related. That is, the more educated one becomes, the less likely it is that one becomes a resident in a penal facility.
Yeah, and yet the state of California, as I recall, in the 90s, built something like 20 major prisons and only added one campus to the California State University. I'm not sure if I have the statistics exactly right, but during the 90s, there was a big push across the country to privatize prisons, and we've developed this incredible prison industrial complex, and these prisoners then become labor, actually, for corporations, very cheap labor.
For the corporations, they become profit vectors for places like CCOA, the Correctional Corporation of America, that runs a lot of those private prisons. They become places where a corporation, as is the case in a lot of the country, literally leases the prison from the state and charges the state X dollars for each prisoner there. And the way the corporation makes money is to charge the state much more than it costs to house and take care of the prisoners. It's a classic moral hazard there. They're motivated, highly motivated, to treat people worse. And, of course, when people are treated worse and become more desperate, they turn, not too surprisingly, to desperate measures. In other words, they commit even more crimes.
Yeah, so the profit incentive becomes a key factor in any endeavor which is taken from the public sector and privatized. We've seen the same thing with health care. We've seen the same thing, we're seeing the same thing with water systems in this state especially, but all around the world. We've seen the same thing in war. War has become a more privatized endeavor where you have Blackwater and lots of subcontractors who are actually carrying out the fighting. And in each case, of course, as you say, the corporation then functions much like Mr. 5%, only they don't stop at 5%. More like 40% or 50%, I think. But they skim off an enormous amount at the top. So then the public then is left holding the bag with paying the greater expenses and often not getting better service at all.
No, in fact, you mentioned earlier the notion of transparency, and I think that's a key issue here, because what we're talking about is a public institution, an institution that functions on yours and mine and everybody else's tax dollars. And classic, one of the trade-offs of public institutions has been you get to use the public's money, but you have to tell the public in detail what happens to that money. What we're seeing these days is that the people that run institutions like ours, people that run cities, the people that run counties would rather not tell us what they're doing with money because they'd like to do what they want to do with the money, not necessarily what we want them to do. And so within our campus, there's a campaign of obfuscation. You mentioned earlier the University Budget Committee. One of the sad realities of my life as a member of that committee is that I have had to file Public Records Act requests for the audited financial statements of this institution. They're unwilling to give me the financial statements. The committee has done its darndest to ask for information about how we're spending money. And we struggle and struggle and struggle. In the last several months, they've started making more information available. I think that has to do with, truthfully, how much hell we raised about not getting it and how embarrassing it was for them to try to explain to the newspaper why they weren't willing to share the audited financial statement about what they did with tax dollars. That's, again, one of those classic conundrums with people that are in the public sector. We get the public's money, and a lot of us feel that we have a moral as well as statutory duty to do with that money what people want. But it's very hard narrow constraints around what people want. And when we add on to that the notion that most universities, including ours, have these auxiliary organizations called foundations that hold donations, things get a lot worse. For instance, Sonoma State University has a foundation. That's where money that people donate to the university goes. Sits in Sonoma State's foundation. And the foundation board of directors decides what to do with that money. For a lot of the donations, the people donating money will specify. They'll say this money is to be used for a building or this money is to be used for scholarships. One of the things that's been public in the last several months as information comes out is that among the board of directors of Sonoma State was a mortgage banker, sort of real estate person, and it turns out that one of the things Sonoma State did with its millions of dollars was provide loans to him so he could buy property. We know about this because somewhere about a year ago, he wrote Sonoma State's foundation and said, excuse me, but I'm not going to be able to pay those loans back. So over $1 million of money donated to the university for the purpose of, one assumes, furthering the purpose of the university, providing education, turned out to have been loaned to somebody who had been a member of the board of directors and who had arranged the loans. That's a problem on our own university. We have a foundation. People give money to it. One of the things that happened last year was our president decided that he needed a new state vehicle. Understandable. He does a lot of business for the state. He didn't want to have one of those Ford Tauruses or Chevrolet Caprices, whatever it is the state will allow us to buy. He preferred something a little more upscale, shall we say. The state purchasing agent said, well, no, we actually cannot buy those sorts of cars with state money. There are rules on how we can spend state money. So what happened was, the Stanislaus Foundation went over to Fitzpatrick's Lexus dealership and bought a Lexus SUV with foundation funds and then donated it to the state for the use of the president.
Just a moment. Let me go ahead and say this is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And we're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And tonight, our guest is Dr. Steve Filling, and my co-host is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and we'll go ahead and let them get back into their conversation. And I just wanted to add to where I feel this is really important is what's going on in your state is going to spread or has spread to the rest of the country, correct?
Yes. In fact, you could argue that California has fairly long history of being a leader in trends in higher education, as in a lot of other vectors. Part of that has to do with the fact that California jumped out in front with the master plan for higher education in the 60s. Part of it has to do with the fact that California is really big. So for a lot of organizations, they'd like to make things work in California because if they can, they can go to the rest of the nation and say, hey, we made it work there, we can do it for you. And indeed, what we see when we look at universities across the nation now is exactly that sort of trend of, well, let's hire some more administrators to make sure that the rest of these people aren't slacking off because we want them to work harder. Let's charge our students more. Let's cut back on classes. Let's change the discourse. Rather than talking to people about their right to an education, which, showing my age, is what I was told when I was growing up in the 60s, you have the right to an education that is something our society wants to provide. Instead of that, now we talk, as President Shivani does, of people who have the elitist attitude that they are owed an education. And they should understand education is a privilege. And again, from his example, people should understand they have to do the dishes if they want to have the ice cream. And we do see that echoing across the country, sadly. A fair number of state universities have now become, as they put it, state-assisted. That is, they've been encouraged to, rather than get their funding from the state, which comes with a lot of controls on what they can do with money, they've been encouraged to go other places. So they will have the business program named after a wealthy business person who, in exchange for millions of dollars, gets to put their name at the front of the college and who typically has some input into what's taught there, which has some really chilling implication for our society.
But that hasn't been going on all along?
In a sense, it has, just nowhere near the level. Up until probably 15 years ago, the vast majority of what were called state universities got the majority of their funding from the state. Now, there always have been some exceptions, I suspect. For instance, Berkeley is probably one of those exceptions. Places that have gotten a lot of money from elsewhere, but by and large, most of them got the majority of their funding from the state, and they followed the state's guidelines when they did things like decide what they were going to do with that money, what they bought, how they offered classes for students. That's changed radically in the last 5 years. The pace of change has accelerated greatly. Part of that has to do with the general economic downturn. People are paying lower taxes and fewer taxes, so that states have less money to hand out. So the institutions are told, go look elsewhere. Again, the governing metaphor seems to be education as an economic transaction. You're getting something of value, therefore you should pay for it.
Yeah. Now, like I say, I'm often and regularly learning from my students. One of my former students emailed me a couple articles from an educator in Oakland by the name of Steve Miller, and I think I sent them to both of you. The first one is called Wall Street Wants to Milk the UC Cash Cow. So maybe if we can kind of step back and look at the bigger picture a little bit, we can maybe talk about some of the reasons why these systemic changes are being implemented from the top down. This is not coming from the people of California or any of the other states. This is coming from our leaders. So anyway, it starts out something like this. The day that UC Regents announced a 32% increase in student fees, the California legislative analyst stated that the state faces at least 5 years of $20 billion-plus deficits. The conjunction of these two events dramatizes the central fact that Wall Street is calling the shots in the California crisis. California claims that the Wall Street's collapse meant that corporations couldn't pay taxes last year. Therefore, quote, we have no choice but to, quote, make cuts across the board in 2009. So if the budget crisis 2009 is as bad as this, what will budget crises 2 through 6 mean? And then he talks about how, therefore, it would appear that these changes are being driven from above by Wall Street. And meanwhile, of course, our gubernator, Arnold Schwarzenegger, immediately said that this crisis would not be solved by increasing taxes, that there would be no tax increases. Therefore, if you've got these debts and you have to cut back social services to balance the budget and you're not increasing your tax revenues, all you can really do then is mandate drastic cutbacks, which would almost seem like an ideal implementation of the Republican operative Grover Norquist, who's a real Washington, D.C., think tank leader of, I think, Americans for Tax Reform. He said under the Bush administration that his goal was to reduce the size of government in 20 years until it is so small that it can be drowned in a bathtub. And, of course, what he's talking about is money spent on social services such as education and health care and police and fire departments, et cetera. And so what we're seeing then is kind of a squeeze play, I think, maybe deliberate huge financial meltdown from above, and then we have in place our Republican gubernator, a chancellor that has always wanted to downsize and cut back the California State University, and we have in place certain presidents. Now, another one of my students came across with a term that he says is that they use in political science. It's called agency capture, such as what we saw under Ronald Reagan when he put James Watt, who was a lobbyist for the oil and gas industry from Wyoming, in charge of the Department of Interior. And the cartoonists were saying, okay, you've got the fox guarding the chicken coop. So you put people in key positions such as Helen Gorsuch or whatever her name was, the head of the EPA, people who are lobbyists for the opposition, and therefore you gut and you you take those agencies and you make them ineffective and piecemeal dismantle them. So I think we could almost say that what we have in our university system is agency capture. We have ideologues who have this Republican view that spending money on social sector services is not good. The money would be better spent as tax cuts to the rich or whatever, or wars abroad or something. But we can't have money spent on the middle class, because then we'd have a middle class that could think critically and could question our decisions. Would you? I know I've said a mouthful there, Steve, but could you suggest what your reaction is to the idea that a lot of this is being driven from above and even from Wall Street?
I have a couple really clear examples for you. I have an acquaintance who is a research chemist who actually did work with the effects of nicotine on the human body and did a lot of studies using various animals looking at how nicotine damages not only the cells in your system, but it damages the cell's DNA so that the cells can't heal the damage after the nicotine goes away. This person worked at a state university, I'm not going to say which state, it wasn't California, and that university was receiving significant funds from the Tobacco Institute of America, which was at that time, and I think still is, effectively a front for huge tobacco companies. One of the conditions of getting that money was that the tobacco companies got to look at all the research projects before they were published. And there were very strong intimations that certain things probably should not be published. Another story, 1999, the University of California at Berkeley had signed, I think, late November 1988, signed an agreement with Novartis, which is a Swiss-based pharmaceutical giant. And basically, the idea was Berkeley got, I think, somewhere around $25 million over 4 or 5 years, and was supposed to fund basic research in the biology department there. In exchange for that, Berkeley gave Novartis first rights on some fraction, I think, between a third and a half of the discoveries that were made. The one thing that's going on here is a giant pharmaceutical company is outsourcing its research to the university. And one of the things that's true about universities like Berkeley is that they have huge numbers of graduate students who have to do research to complete their degrees and who work really, really cheap. So this is a really good example of how a huge major international corporation can shift the cost of research off to a university, probably by donating, I don't know, $25 million rather than spending $50 million on its own labs. They take advantage of what goes on in the public sector. That happens throughout. That is a pretty good example of that notion of agency capture. And I think flavoring that in something you alluded to, Eric, what Naomi Klein refers to as disaster capitalism. That is, the notion that people react differently during a disaster. They're more inclined to accept the fact that something has to be done and go along obediently with whatever happens. I think you see that when you look at higher education and the constant stream of disasters, if you will. Oh, our budget's not good. So we've got to, in the case of one campus, kill off economics. Well, okay, that's a big thing, but we're in a big problem, so okay, we'll let you kill off economics. And the next year, well, the budget's better, however, we have this other problem. There's a constant stream of sometimes artfully constructed disasters, reasons why people should just go along, and it allows people in charge of an organization incredible latitude, incredible freedom of action to do what they wish. On my campus, President Shirvani is engaged in exactly the same thing. He prefaces, every public statement with a reference to budget's bad, things are horrible, we're desperate, and that provides some legitimation, some cover for what he thinks he wants to do. And a lot of times, the things he says he wants to do, for instance, getting rid of our winter term, don't really have much of an effect on what he says is a disaster. He says we have a real budget problem, so we got to get rid of winter term. The most compelling evidence I've seen says that at best we might save maybe $100,000. It actually might cost us $100,000 to get rid of winter term. That's not something that's going to solve the problem of winter term, but he seeks to legitimate it by saying emergency, emergency. And that's arguably the same thing you see if you look at our government on a national level over the past decade. It's a crisis. Let us do what we want. September 11th happened. Therefore, you have no individual freedoms, no liberty anymore.
Yeah, Naomi Klein's book is called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And what she's talking about is this deliberate taking advantage of and manipulation of a traumatic event, whether it's natural event or whether it's manufactured, and many, of course, are manufactured just for this purpose. And then when people are psychologically traumatized, their moorings are, they're psychologically unmoored, then they are likely to, then the power elite can therefore slip by whatever changes they want to redesign and reorganize the system. And this, I think, is part of what you were referring to earlier called the art of creative destruction. You destroy a system and then you redesign it and rebuild it in your own image. And this, I think, is what is happening to our public education around the country. And I'll just go back to this article a little bit here. He's saying universities across the country took a huge financial hit in the Wall Street meltdown. Harvard University last year responded differently than UC to the economic crisis. They halted all construction, but the UCs are continuing to build. At UC Berkeley, for example, the campus is undergoing massive construction to build a new world-class biotech college. This is a gift to the major corporations that fund and profit from UC Berkeley, namely, as you mentioned, Novartis and other big pharma corporations. So what we're seeing then, the regents have raised fees for students because these increases that they have made have already been factored in by Wall Street. They've already been securitized and they're necessary as securitization to provide collateral for loans, principally construction loans. So in a sense, the money has been spent before the increases in tuition were made. This is what he's saying here. And he's saying, well, okay, what does securitization mean? It means during the great financial bubble of 2002 through 2007, hotshot graduates from the UC, the Ivy Leagues, and many universities quickly found jobs paying six figures by inventing securitization. These so-called financial instruments were part of the great Wall Street Ponzi scheme. Make speculative bets on credit with no money up front, just pay out of the profits. Securitizing mortgages set off such a rush that by 2008 the whole thing collapsed. But Wall Street is still all about securitizing things, since this produces a really hot profit on paper, if not reality. Speculation still drives the casino economy, and this drives Wall Street. It's all about creating the next bubble. So other things that are being securitized include water in California, very highly securitized. You can buy paper water, promises upon delivery, and then sell them cheap or dear. This is what Enron tried to do with California's electricity in 1998. Even though the corporation went bankrupt, the state is still paying off the $40 billion owed. Securitizing mortgages broke the banks, but it still hasn't ceased. The latest scam is to securitize and bundle life insurance policies. Wall Street global warming solutions are all about creating a market for the atmosphere. Carbon trading is just a way to float paper to speculate on the rate of escalating pollution. And no one has yet publicized how often UC student payments have been securitized. But you can be sure that this wasn't the first time. You can also bet that the process is accelerating. When 170,000 undergrads each pay $10,300, you wind up with $1.75 trillion. That's a nice pool of revenue that corporations could divert to bigger things. Add in more increases for grad students, California State University, and community college students, and you're talking some real money. What do you think about that?
I think it's exactly correct. I study what goes on in the business world, and a lot of what I see is exactly that. There's a huge rush to, in one sense, to offset risk, and that is, again, the nascence of what went wrong with the mortgage market. People saying, okay, we've got mortgages. Well, people saying we have some money, let's loan it. Somebody wants to buy a house, they'll pay us interest and pay us back our money. That worked okay, but it didn't generate enough profit, so let's sell our loans to somebody else. And, in fact, let's sell the payment stream here, and we'll sell the deed to the house over here, and we'll sell the risk that somebody is going to pay us or not pay us over here, creating instruments so complex that, quite literally, I think most of the CEOs of the major investment banks didn't understand what they were buying and selling. What they saw it as is a risk-free transaction. We engage in this, and we earn 12%, and there's no risk, so let's do it a whole bunch. And they did it a whole bunch, and what they discovered, much to our expense, was that, well, there was some risk there. But it all goes back to the understanding of the world as a zero-sum game, that the way I can become better off is to take advantage of you.
Mm. Yeah, unfortunately, that is the mentality that drives the system. There's a blog that came out, I think, in November 20th. Radio Democracy Now! Interviewed Bob Samuels. Okay, this is from a Democracy Now! Show. Bob Samuels, president of the University of California American Federation of Teachers. He runs a blog called Changing Universities. He reported another example of how high finance drives the process. He said, I think Chancellor Mark Udoff, he's the main chancellor of UC, I believe, University of California, his main strategy is basically to blame the state for everything while they try to privatize the university. And the very telling moment came. After the UC's budget was cut by the state, the UC turned around and lent $200 million to the state. And people said, how can you lend $200 million to the state while you're giving faculty furloughs and while you're raising student fees and while you're cutting classes? And he said, when we lend money to the state, we make a profit from interest. But when we spend money just on teachers' salaries, that money just disappears. So from his perspective, instruction is a losing proposition, and the university should just try to get out of the business of basically teaching students and hiring faculty. That's a quote from Bob Samuels. And I can go on here and another tidbit I think maybe some of our students should know in order to protect their interests. The UC Regents have been headed for years by billionaire developer Richard Blum. Blum is the husband of Senator Dianne Feinstein, the richest person in the U.S. Senate. Blum joins the notorious Eli Broad as perfect examples of how the FIRE sector, and the FIRE here stands for Finance, Insurance, and Real Estate, operates and its newfound interest in all forms of public education. More than anything else, Wall Street manufacturers create credit by creating debt. The debt guarantees a cash flow as long as the economy doesn't melt down. When it did last year, the bailout was openly designed to guarantee banks could start lending again, i.e. manufacturing debt. Hence the $61.7 billion bailout of AIG Insurance. This open scam was simply a pass-through operation so that AIG's creditors could be bailed out. AIG developed from Sun America Insurance, started by Eli Broad, with billions from his Southern California real estate project. Broad was still in charge of the corporation's retirement funds last year. Broad is also the country's number one billionaire activist and philanthropreneur who pushes corporatization, privatization, and securitization onto the country's K-12 schools. Executives trained at Broad's Academy have taken over more school districts in more than a dozen major cities, including Oakland, Detroit, Washington, D.C., where they close public schools and open charters. So the privatization plan does seem to be driven by the financial elite, and it does seem to affect all sectors of public education from K-12 right up through UC graduate school. So the Wall Street intends to profit by seizing and stripping these public assets as states find themselves in artificial debt crises and stampede into desperation fire sales.
Yep, Sandy, you'll see a simultaneous trend towards more direction about what does go on. So at the same time they're trying to take money out of the system to reduce the services provided, you'll see lots more mandate on what has to happen. So my poor colleagues that teach in K-12 systems are subject to an incredible and truthfully rather arcane plethora of rules. Here's how many minutes you must spend talking about algebra with one variable. Here's how many minutes you must spend talking about algebra with two variables. Here's how many minutes the students must spend reading each day. That is, the legislature and the regulatory bodies take on more and more and more control over what actually goes on. And that limits our ability to educate effectively. And if we look at what happens in K-12 schools throughout the country, I think we see the results of that. Very few people would argue that students coming out of high school are well-prepared to enter college now. Most would argue they're much less well-prepared than they were 20 years ago. And if you look at what's happened between 20 years ago and now, you see lots of legislative and statutory interference with what goes on in the classroom. Lots of principals wanting to sign off on lesson plans instead of accepting that the teachers are there because they actually want to do a good job.
You know, that template I recognize from back when I worked at a factory back in the early 70s.
Could you speak louder, Melody?
That template I watched back in the early 70s when I was working at a factory, that they actually had us time down to the second on how long we did things.
There's a marvelous text by a psychopath named Frederick Winslow Taylor called Scientific Management. And he's one of the first, this is dating back to about 1910. He's one of the people that originated that notion that we could be as efficient as possible if we approach things as a science. So he would do things like measure the number of inches between your desk and the file cabinet and how long it should take you and which way you should turn. Doing what's called these days efficiency engineering. And I think that's part of what you're describing, Melody, is people saying, we can structure this so it's as efficient as possible. And in a sense, that works. But the sense that that works is that everything has to always be the same.
Well, you know, one of the downside to that, though, is I got to watch on a periodic, about a 3 or 4 month period when they would go through and have these engineers come through and measure how much time we could get something done, and then they would turn around and raise our incentive time so that the people worked that much faster, that every 3 months they had to stick a number of us back in the warehouse tearing everything apart that came back. And we were working with surgical trays that had to be sterile, and we were finding things in there that should have never been in there.
Sure. I mean, a similar occurrence, I worked in a factory when I was in graduate school. My job was to take boxes off the end of the machine and put them on a conveyor belt. And as I was doing that one night, I noticed that the conveyor belt had become kinked and the boxes were all falling off the conveyor belt about 10 feet away. So I went down there and started picking them up off the floor and putting them back on the belt. My supervisor came by. What do you think you're doing? I said, well, I'm putting the boxes back in the belt. And his response was, well, nobody told you to do that. Get back to your station. So I went back to my station, and for the rest of the night, I put boxes on the conveyor belt, and 10 feet down the belt, they fell off. And by the time I left, there was a really big pile of boxes 10 feet away, which actually probably was not very efficient, but it was caused by people saying, we know how to structure this environment so it works. And what it leads to is exactly what you described, people trying to live up to these impossible standards and making mistakes, and you ending up every 3 months having to go off in the warehouse and try to catch those mistakes and fix them.
Okay, well, if I could put another wrinkle in that's introduced in one of these articles, these two articles by Steve Miller, this educator and columnist out of Oakland, he says, in reality, however, and he talks about how neoliberal reforms, the kind of structural adjustment programs which the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have imposed on third world countries that are in their debt, how these neoliberal reforms are now coming home at last, and the people of the U.S. are getting hard lessons in what the economics and politics of globalization and neoliberalism have already done to the rest of the world. Now it's happening here. So we're looking at the third worldification of America now. But then he says the economics and politics of neoliberalism are a powerful dynamic, but they are not what's driving the process. He says we can't combat them properly if we don't go deeper. He says, in reality, public education has never been about the kids. Our public schools have always been structured to serve the labor market, and the current technology always drives the labor market. In 1900, over 50% of the U.S. population worked in farms. The educational system was designed to support what a rural workforce needed in order to work and produce. Students only went to the eighth grade. This gave us summer vacation so the kids could help bring in the crop on the farm. By the 1920s, assembly line industry, which is what you're talking about, was rising, and public education was configured to create an industrial workforce. By 1950, 50% of the U.S. population worked in industry, and the, quote, factory school was in place. Students were considered parts on an assembly line that moved from station to station or from period to period throughout the day, where the workers or teachers could shape them. However, by 2000, the computer was the rising technology, and today 50% of the U.S. workforce works in various computer-assisted, quote, services, unquote. The industrial system of education is today becoming outmoded by technological change to electronics. A new world is emerging, and a new post-industrial world is taking shape, one with post-industrial politics and new ideas. However, everything turns on one basic fact. Computer-driven production replaces human labor. So as long as corporations control this technology, they will configure it to their benefit. The assault against public schools, then, is driven by this fact. No corporation is going to pay to educate people they cannot exploit. Electronics polarizes the labor market into a tiny section of highly paid professionals, scientists, and managers, surrounded with a sea of low-paid, low-skilled service and production workers who can read simple directions and repeat formulas like, "May I take your order now?" Education policy quickly follows. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I think you can see precisely that if you look at discussions going on about curriculum in higher education. There's much talk in the last couple of years about European universities having three-year degree programs, and there's a lot of discussion in the States about how do we get people graduated more efficiently, which largely is defined as into university and out as quickly as possible. One of the things that comes up is usually, well, that general education stuff, that, you know, liberal arts education, they don't need that. So there's in a very real sense, there's a very concerted effort to remove the very things that we say we value, things like critical thinking skills, ability to analyze situations, from the educational mix at places like the CSU. As you note, there is this need for a small cadre of very bright people, so critical thinking skills are still taught at places like Claremont, at places like UC Berkeley, but the notion is, well, we don't think we need so much of that at the CSU because we're going to tell these people what to do and really don't want to have a conversation with them about it. We want them to just follow instructions. A very real sort of degrading of the education we're providing, and I think it arises in part from precisely the sorts of situations you talk about. And I'll note with respect to Miller's work, some of it I agree with, but I think one of the things he leaves out is happenstance. It is true indeed that in sort of the dawn of public education, we were in agricultural society, and summer vacations came about because, as you say, the kids needed to be at home working on the farm. But it turns out one of the things we've discovered over time is that education, learning, happens best when there are spaced intervals for digestion. And it turns out those summers are incredibly useful, allowing people to sort of accumulate facts September through May, and then maybe June, July, and August. They do some internal sorting and shoeboxing of those facts and putting them into arrangements where they can access them easily. That is, that break is really important. So when we return and say, well, we need to be more efficient with the way we utilize our campus, which a lot of times is bureaucrats speak for, we need to be offering classes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, we fail to acknowledge that knowledge is not something we can just dump into people ceaselessly. We actually have to give them time to process it and reflect upon it. And again, I think that arises because people focus on becoming maximally efficient with only one of those vectors. And in the case of higher ed, what they've chosen largely is use of the building. If there are not 28 butts in the 28 seats in this room, we're not being maximum. We're not maximizing our efficiency, so we need to make that happen. Instead of maximizing the amount of learning that goes on, we maximize the number of bodies in a room for a maximal number of hours in a day. Those are very different things, and they can lead us to very different places.
It seems to me that in the article that Shirvani wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Education, did he not, or maybe this was one of his other articles, and I know he's got a number of his articles posted online if people wanted to look at them on the California State University Stanislaus website. He does post some of his think pieces on there. As I recall, he has a kind of a vision for two major kinds of universities in the future. And I think it would more or less dovetail with the, you know, the needs of the post-industrial society that I mentioned. But in neither of those two categories, I mean, California State University doesn't really fit any of those two categories. In other words, if you look at his own vision for the future, the California State University would have to go extinct.
I think that's correct, and I think truthfully, that's one of the things he believes in. He talks a lot about the notion of reinventing and reengineering and reimagining. And that's an interesting idea if one has a vision. But to date, his vision largely seems to be, let's destroy what's there. I don't see much in terms of what are we going to provide instead of that. I see stories about we need to make do with less. I see stories about people should not think this is a right, it's a privilege. I see stories about people should accept my vision. What I don't see is his vision.
Yeah, well, now there, I guess we should talk a little bit about the pushback that has occurred. Since we had our last interview, the Faculty Senate decided to take it to a vote of the faculty to see if there was if the faculty had confidence in his ability to lead the university. And the vote came back, 91% of the faculty did not have confidence in his ability to lead or the direction of his leadership. So we have 91% no confidence in his leadership. And we've also had, as you say, a number of these demonstrations, these mock funerals on campus. Students are pushing back. At the beginning of this last fall, he was able to control, I think, the kind of press coverage that came out in the Modesto Bee through his PR people, and the faculty had virtually no voice in the Modesto Bee. As I understand it, one of his board members or one of his foundation members is the editor of the Modesto Bee, so he has kind of a cozy relationship there. But it seems that his ability to control perceptions has now completely shut down. So could you maybe summarize what you think are the chances that the people, the democratic processes might provide a countervailing force that might offset some of these changes implemented that are coming from the top?
I think it's almost inevitable that they will. Largely, to my thinking, it's a question of timing. As you say, the faculty, 90% of the faculty spoke, and 91% of them said, we do not think this person is able to do his job effectively. And they're saying that for a lot of the reasons I've been enunciating, primarily, where is his vision, and how does it relate to what the mission of this institution is? Now, having a lack of vision obviously is not a fatal flaw, but it certainly doesn't help one to be a leader. I think what we've discovered is, despite the amount of money the university puts into media relations and into carefully scripted press announcements and interviews, it's pretty clear that that vision is not something that's shared by the majority of the people on our campus. It's also true that that is a vision that might be shared by people that work in large corporations, especially people that run large corporations. But there are people that think, yep, Giovanni knows the way to go. And they get maximal exposure because those are indeed the people with the money, the people that go to the country club with the editors of the newspapers. And I know that both newspapers in our service area and the local service area have had repeated interactions with him. I know that CSU staff have gone over to the newspapers and basically said, here's the way this needs to be reported. And in large part, this needs to be reported as marginalizing dissent. What's happened since the faculty voted is it's become effectively impossible to marginalize that dissent.
Yeah, that was you. He wanted to marginalize the campus leaders such as yourself, Steve, and a few others, and say they're calling you names like toxic leadership, et cetera. And as I recall, many, many departments said, we totally support our campus leadership, and that tactic of divide and conquer didn't fly.
No, it didn't, and it's becoming apparent more and more as our students become more active, as the press find that they really don't have much choice. They have to report on this stuff. So there are articles coming out. There are other points of view coming out. And it becomes clearer and clearer that there are a couple thousand people on our campus who care very deeply about that institution and really believe in the mission, educating the people of California, educating people like me, first-generation college students. Nobody in my family had ever had a degree before. That's a tough job, but it's one we do well. It's not one that Giovanni's vision allows us to continue doing well, and people are starting to see that. The community is starting to find out that, well, okay, he says he needs to be more efficient and shove some more students in a classroom. I can understand why that would be a good thing and save money. And now they're starting to see the other side of that, that it also means that there's less time for the teachers to interact with those students to help them get through the class. That is, there's more of a chance that their niece or their nephew or their grandson isn't going to get through college. They're starting to see the downside of that focus on efficiency by shoving more people in the room.
Yeah.
I think that leads eventually to a much more nuanced public understanding of what passes for that vision of entrepreneurialism. I think people start to see this is actually a discussion about a public good. It's a discussion about the public good called education, opportunity for the populace. It's not a discussion about should we spend $10 here or $10 over there. It's a discussion about how do we provide a good that our society agrees is a worthy thing to have?
Well, to give people an idea of how locked out of the media our faculty felt, I think it was probably late November, early December, when one of our campus leaders, a Senate member, came by my office and asked me and other faculty to contribute to some money so that we could take out an $1,800 ad in the local Modesto Bee. In other words, the letters that were being written by our faculty were not being printed by our local main local paper, mainly because of the influence peddling that our president had managed to do and his contacts there. And I don't think that ad was ever placed, but I know I gave him $20 and my colleague gave him $50 or $40. The idea that faculty should have to take out an ad to get their point expressed when we, in fact, are working at a public education system and trying to represent the public, to me, is perverse.
Yeah, there was actually a full-page ad in a local newspaper, the Modesto Bee, yesterday. It was an open letter from the board of directors of the foundation, and those are usually very wealthy, very influential community members. For instance, there's the chief executive of the Turlock Irrigation District. There is the president of Associated Feed. There are a couple lawyers, a couple doctors, the chairman and CEO of MP Biomedical, the president of PF Medicals, the CEO of the Bank in Agriculture and Commerce. These are people with a lot of money. They are people that have, I think, probably ties to the community. They're people that want to do good. However, what they're not is people that spend any time on the campus of our university. They are not people that talk to anybody other than Ham Shravani and Kristen Olson, the PR person. I know that part of the reason the faculty were trying to collect money was to produce something exactly like this to say, here is why we're making this upset. It's not because we want more money, because truthfully, we're pretty sure we're not going to get more money by changing attitudes in the local population. What we are trying to do is help you understand that what's going on with public money here is probably not a good thing, that we may not be doing exactly what you want us to, and we'd like to change that. And, by the way, Eric, that ad probably is going to be coming out in the next week or so. It just seems to take forever to get people to agree on the text.
Now, tell me, this ad that came out yesterday or today, was this more or less in support of our president, or was it in support of our faculty?
No, it was very much in support of our president. It makes statements like, I'm trying to find the one. Here it is. Suggestions from some of the university's faculty that President Shravani excludes them from the decision-making process are misguided, false, and counterproductive. President Shravani regularly provides opportunities for consultation and collaboration with faculty, staff, students, and the greater community. I can speak from my own experience as a member of the leadership of the faculty on this campus. I have been refused admittance to meetings where the president is talking to students because he refuses to let any faculty be in the room. I have been denied access to the financial statements of this institution, which is a body of the state and has a legal mandate to provide financial statements to the public. I have repeatedly over the past year asked him to speak with us, and up until last week then basically ignored. So I think only people who don't have much connection with the campus can make these sorts of statements with a straight face.
Although I'm sure they were helped in couching those statements by the people who are designed to be the PR people for the president, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it really disturbs me that at the bottom of this full-page letter from the board of directors, which is a very partisan letter, is a fifth of a page picture of one of those big piles of bricks at our front entrance that says California State University Stanislaus. It disturbs me that people who aren't associated with the university would read this and think, well, this is, excuse me, an official publication of the university.
Yeah.
It's not. It's somebody else's opinion. And it's not an opinion I share. One of the things that we teach our students is that they need to critically evaluate evidence. They need to seek multiple perspectives. And part of what we've been trying to do for the past 5 years while Shravani has been here is get people to allow those multiple perspectives to be enunciated. What's happened is that President Shravani likes to hear what he already agrees with, and he doesn't like to hear people that don't agree with him. So in one sense, his executive office has a chilling resemblance to the White House of Richard Nixon in 1971 when the Watergate hearings were in process.
In other words, the axe falls and people's heads roll and people are fired.
And he only tolerates people who will repeat to him what he tells them. He does not deal well with dissent, and dissent is the lifeblood of the university.
Yeah. Well, going back to Steve Miller's article, which I find so very interesting and provocative, he just reading here, it says, back in the 1990s, Edward Luttwak, a champion of the free market, described the agenda this way. So to try to get in the minds of the people who wrote that ad and our leaders, he could be describing public school policy for the U.S. today. Quote, from Edward Lutwick. At present, almost all the elite Americans, with corporate chiefs and fashionable economists in the lead, are utterly convinced that they have discovered the winning formula for economic success. The only formula, good for every country, rich or poor, good for all individuals willing and able to heed the message, and of course, good for elite Americans, in capital letters, privatization plus deregulation plus globalization equals turbo capitalism equals prosperity. And this is coming from Thomas Frank, One Market Under God, written in 2000. This statement is a clear statement of intent to privatize everything, everything of nature, every human relationship, to broker every aspect of human society under the market with access only for a price. Behind such wondrous proclamations, the so-called free market stands revealed as nothing more than a fig leaf for corporate crime.
The base level of the notion of a free market rests upon choice and upon processing of information. So what makes a free market free is that you're free to buy from me or not. In other words, you have alternatives. Turns out in our society, there aren't so many alternatives. If you want to have a bank account, you can go to a bank. Chances are good you're going to hit Bank of America or Wells Fargo. One of the things that we see happening over time is that people don't like the way they're treated at those banks, so they go off to a small local bank. And the way Bank of America grows is by buying up the small local banks. That is, reducing your choice. The market is not free when there aren't many sellers and many buyers. And the goal of the capitalist, succinctly put, is to make sure they are the only seller. That is, to remove that free choice that makes the market free in the first place. It's a very tautologic philosophy that, frankly, I don't think holds water when it's inspected.
Well, didn't John D. Rockefeller say competition is a sin? And so, of course, his version of capitalism is monopoly capitalism.
Well, that's everybody's version. There is a slightly mediated version, which people refer to as crony capitalism, which probably is, I don't know, highlighted by Blackwater, by KBR, organizations that, through the government, managed to effectively achieve the equivalent of a monopoly by destroying the free market. What happened after Katrina was a good example of that. There were thousands and thousands of contracts for hundreds of millions, indeed billions of dollars, let without competition. There's no free market there.
Yeah, that's a classic example of the shock doctrine that Naomi Klein talks about in her book, about how about Katrina, the tragedy at New Orleans was immediately taken advantage of. In fact, Miller mentions that he says the tragedy of New Orleans shows what's in store for everyone. The disaster wasn't so much the storm as the response. More federal troops were used in New Orleans than anywhere in the U.S. since the Civil War. Their mission was to guarantee the vast privatization of government services, including firing every public school teacher and opening up boutique public schools for the rich, while the poor are slammed into unfunded charter schools. So that gives us our two-tier society, a small group of rich and then everybody else who's, I guess, a servant or essentially a wage slave.
Won't Haiti follow suit on this?
Pardon?
Won't Haiti follow suit on this?
Well, yeah, Haiti, much worse.
What you're going to see is the same thing you saw in the Maldives after the tsunami went through. All the people who used to live in Haiti anywhere within 2 miles of the beach will be moved somewhere else, and the multinational hotel chains and resorts will come in, and it's nicer than Costa Rica in the advertising campaigns. It's a great mechanization for privatization of everything.
Yeah.
The notion that the people that have lived in Haiti historically, well, they live there, that's nice, but that's not going to be the dollars and cents economic value we can get from renting overpriced rooms to overweight white people. So we'll kick all of them out, and we'll let Marriott and Hilton and Sheraton and all the other chains build their resorts there, take away what used to be a public resource and turn it into a private one, and then say, well, see, we can show you an economic development survey of Haiti that says that they have a lot more capital flowing in. What it does not say is see people are better off because they won't be.
Yeah, and of course we know, I don't know what the latest estimates are, but I've heard 100,000 have died, and I imagine that it will go higher. So, it does not measure the suffering, the human cost. But it is a classic example of what Naomi Klein talked about in her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and how this actually was taught at the Chicago School of Milton Friedman's economics group. The Chicago Boys were trained in this the shock doctrine, this disaster capitalism, and implemented it as the coup in Chile in 1973, orchestrated by Kissinger and Nixon, became the opportunity then for all these Friedman-trained economists, many of whom were South American from Chile, to go in and completely restructure the Chilean economy along the lines of privatization, capitalism, monopoly capitalism, and I think at least 30,000 citizens were murdered and disappeared, but they don't often talk about that. They just talk about all the benefits that came from this this restructuring that occurred. So Chile is another good example. The 1973 coup in Chile is another example that Naomi Klein uses. I really recommend that book for everybody who's listening, because this, once you start to see the pattern, I think we might be able to start catching the criminals in red-handed, because we see that this same tactic is being used over and over and over again. As sooner or later, we're going to have to take these corporate criminals and throw them in jail.
And we could trace that into Haiti pretty effectively. Maybe one of the most obvious points is, several years ago, there famously was a garbage scow flooding off the east coast of the States with several thousand tons worth of incinerator waste, and they'd tried to take it all sorts of places, and every nation on the planet was saying, no, no, don't dump your crap here. It ended up on the beaches at Haiti. That's where they dumped it. And they did so basically by bribing the local government. Here's a bunch of money. We're dumping lots and lots of tons of trash here. There are huge concentrations of heavy metals. There are all sorts of carcinogenics here. But it's okay. And yet again, push things off to the third world, saying, well, you're so many dollars better off than you were before, and we're going to ignore most of the costs because most of you guys can't afford a doctor anyway, so there is no cost there.
Would you two like to go ahead and give us some closing comments before we finish for the evening? And thank you very much for,
certainly.
Interview.
Thank you, Melody, for hosting us on this discussion. Of course, this is the sort of thing that we really appreciate your efforts. This interview and the previous one that we did last fall are archived on Melody's website, which I think is www.givemesometruth.info. And I've actually had my students, because of our furloughing, we teach less. And some professors figure out ways to, hopefully make up for the content. One of the things that I've asked my students to do is to listen to some of the interviews that I've done on your program, Melody, and including the one with Steve Filling. So I had a number of my students last semester listen to our previous interview, and I'm going to do the same thing again this next semester and ask and more or less assign this so that our students can get this perspective on what's going on. Sometimes they're very savvy, sometimes they're not savvy at all as to what's going on. So this is a great benefit, I think, educational benefit. And of course, I really want to thank Steve for coming on and for his ongoing work and commitment with the California Faculty Association, with the Faculty Senate. He's the Speaker of the Faculty Senate now. He's one of our campus leaders who has been brave enough throughout the entire thing to stand up to power and to try to give the other side. He's weathered several storms now, as we said, where the administration tried to isolate and marginalize our quote-unquote toxic leadership, but the faculty didn't buy into that. So anyway, thank you for joining us, Steve, and I appreciate all your knowledge and all your work on and your commitment on this on these issues.
A brief rejoinder. I'm not sure it's so much strength of character as naive optimism. And probably the most trenchant closing comment I have for anyone listening is it doesn't have to be this way. You can fight back. It does make a difference. Take your society back from those people. You can do it.
We can do it with the democratic institutions that we have in place if we get involved and get informed. And, of course, that's a big part of, you know, what public education is about, ideally, is to help train people to be responsible citizens in a democratically run society. So there's a lot at stake here across the country as our universities are scaled back to varying extents. There has to be some pushback from the people, or else we're going to lose more of our middle class.
Agreed.
Again, yeah.
Thank you, Paul.
Again, thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Good night, Melody. Good night, Steve.
Good night.
Good night.